Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Welcome to UFO, Paranormal, and Mystical Insights. I'm Ruth Anna Martefio, and Stephen Katz is going to take over right now. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Ruth. I appreciate you helping make this possible. And this is the first show of what I hope will be a long series of shows on this topic. There's a fairly high degree of interest amongst the general public and specialists on these areas of knowledge, and I hope to have some guests in besides the dialogue that you and I have, Ruth, to discuss various matters. And I've communicated already with Peter Robbins, who is a recognized UFO expert, who co-wrote a book with a British chap called Left at Eastgate, about a very famous UFO encounter at a U.S. British Air Force base in England in 1982, I believe it was. And I met him at a convention in 1997, which is quite a few years ago now, and I consider him to be, you know, one of the top honest and really hardworking UFO investigators. And as far as the breadth of the show goes, I'm hoping that we can cover the full range of what's commonly known as unexplained phenomena, mystical experiences, and unidentified objects, aerial phenomena, and so on and so forth, interdimensional experiences. And I always like to point out scientifically, because the advanced physicists have finally caught up with what the occult scientists have been saying for centuries, and the mystics, that the visible universe that we see constitutes 4%. So the universe that we see, that's normal matter, and when I say the universe, I just don't mean Earth. I mean, with our telescopes, I mean galaxies. I mean, as much of the being of the entire universe, however that may be constituted. And at a certain point in time, I think it started several decades ago, the theory originally was that because of gravitational attraction, there was a Big Bang, and the entire universe was expanding, but that expansion should slow down, and there was always a big debate. I think the majority of the scientists felt eventually it would contract down back again, because gravity eventually would take hold. And it was, like a pulsation, like an expansion, and then everything would come back together. But as they got more and more sophisticated, they did experiments, and they found out that, lo and behold, it seems that not only is it continuing to expand on the outer edges of it, but it's even increasing in velocity. I mean, it's even expanding further. And they couldn't figure this out, and then indirectly, by looking and measuring gravitational effects, they said, you know what, there's this other stuff here that we can't see and detect that's doing this. And they came out with a figure, a fairly exact figure, based on their experiments, that 75% of the universe is dark energy, 21% is dark matter. We cannot see dark energy or dark matter. And 4% is normal matter, which is, in the scientists, when they say normal matter, they mean atoms and molecules and, you know, the stuff that we see here on Earth or that we can see through our telescopes, planets and galaxies, gases, dust, you know. And now, we don't know what's going on in 96% of the being of the universe, and the physicists have also discovered that there are many dimensions beyond the dimensions that we are existing in. So there is a whole metaphysical domain, I call it, which could very easily constitute many, many other realities. So the fact that we can't see it, which was always the big criticism of spirituality and even organized religion, because they say, you know, you guys are talking about things, and, you know, where is it? I mean, you know, particularly in the Enlightenment when, you know, they were doing experiments and they were saying, well, you know, we throw a ball off, the ball comes down, we make certain conclusions. But what you are talking about, we can't see. But then the only people back then that got a hearing were the mystics, because the mystics would say, look, I had this experience. I saw this being. He or she showed up. They communicated with me, you know, and so on and so forth. And, of course, the Vatican was and has been famous for doing investigations of these kind of phenomena, including the investigation that was undertaken in Spain, Fatima sightings by the peasant children is one story where it's still unexplained to this day scientifically, but given the surrounding circumstances and the testimony that had been taken about it, apparently something did happen, and there was some UFO phenomena, and the children interpreted it according to, you know, their religious faith, but that's still, generally speaking, unexplained beyond, you know, those circles of the Vatican that feel that they, you know that this was an appearance of, you know, a higher spiritual entity and so on and so forth. So,
but, you touched on something really important as far as when you said, you know, to the best of their ability, they described what they saw, like according to their religion, their beliefs. And it's very hard to describe something we have no concept of. So we explain it as we see it.
Well, I mean, the way human consciousness works is that we interpret things according to what we've already been exposed to and know.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting phenomena, but it's also very, I guess for purposes of survival, you know, animals do that too. I mean, you know, they discover that a certain animal they should stay away from through experience, and when they see something that looks like that, they stay away from it. It's vice versa. It's a, you know, but we're using our consciousness based on what we know, and the unknown is always interpreted initially by virtue of the known, and then eventually scientists, philosophers, mystical explorers sometimes have a burst of consciousness expansion, the same way that Einstein was riding a bus and was looking at a clock in Switzerland and was looking at the light coming off the clock and came up with this theory of a relativity based on the speed of light and, you know, about time slowing up and being elastic. And that was a breakthrough in conceptual apperception, which, due to his intelligence, he was able to make. So that's how, you know, knowledge grows. And I think it's a tremendously exciting field. And I've been studying it for decades whenever I had time. And as I've gotten older, and you know, I have more time than I used to when, you know, I was working many more hours than I do work now. But I've always been interested in this, and you know, to me, it's like opening up the box, you know,
right,
and allowing our spirits to soar and allowing our minds to expand. And I think that that is. I think that's very important. I feel that the Earth and atomic matter constitutes a prison-like structure that keeps the spiritual energies limited. And, you know, I think the struggle is to liberate ourselves from this, individual by individual, however we can. And, you know, I'm definitely in favor of a completely free scope of research, you know, of however anybody wants to approach it, because that's the only way we're really going to get the new knowledge. And, you know, I remember my friend Bob, who was my mentor in mysticism. He was a guy, had a PhD from Columbia, and he retired and got into all this stuff. And he said, Steve, he said, look, you know, he says, you know, people tell me, he says, you know, what are you talking about, Bobby, that, you know, you're talking about these angelic presences, or you're talking about, you know, otherworldly entities, and you know, we can't see them. And he used to say, he would tell them, he says, have you ever seen an atom? How do you know an atom exists? And he would say, you know why? Because the scientists have determined that based on the effects, and based indirectly on other things, they were able to tell that certain things do exist. What about some atomic particles? You know, that kind of stuff. And so the point is that that's how the breakthroughs happen. And, I mean, I do know, for one thing, that the Vatican, for many years, has accepted the reality of extraterrestrial intelligences and civilizations. Mm-hmm. And unlike many years ago, when there was that big struggle between science and the church during the Middle Ages, you know, and unfortunately there was an Inquisition at one point, and, you know, there was a lot of... now, I think that they have learned from history, and they're on the cutting edge in certain areas, and UFOs is one of them. The Vatican astronomers and theologians and so on, they've been, you know, interviewed, and they're following this phenomena very closely. And so, you know, it's a vast field, and I think it's just endless. It's as infinite as the subject matter.
Well, this is
you know, I think if we had 100 lifetimes, we couldn't plumb all that. That we could possibly could go into.
No, but this is the best time so far in the history of mankind to learn about it, because we really have access to a lot of this. I mean, sure, there's things in the Vatican Library we don't have access to, but there's so much online and in the great libraries. For people with open minds, it's not that hard to learn more.
Well, the key is open mind, and, you know, and it can be also what I call itinerant inventors or freelance thinkers. You know, you don't need a PhD from MIT. There's a lot of people doing original work, and like Peter Robbins is self-trained in ufology. Well, back when he started out, there were the only people who really claimed to know anything about it were the military people and a few astronomers, and, you know, he's been hard at work, self-taught, and he says, you know, Steve, he says, formal credentials in any of these areas, while they can be important, he says, if you don't have a formal credential, let's say you're not a physicist, or you don't have a PhD in astronomy, he says, you just have to hold yourself to a very high standard
mm-hmm.
in your work, and find out what the accepted standard is, and try to, as best you can, do that. And, you know, so he's been able to do some pretty good work on that. And so nobody should feel inhibited from going ahead and educating themselves. And there are no real experts in these areas. And when I say experts, I say this is new knowledge. There are experts in the sense historically, like Gershom Scholem he's an expert in Jewish mysticism. He spent this many decades, his whole work life, looking into the old Kabbalists and what they were teaching and everything. That's one thing. But what I'm talking about is as we go into the future, I mean, you know, there are no real experts. I mean, 96% of the universe is obviously we can't directly apprehend. It's there, and we know very little about it. So, I mean, that shows you right there. I mean, there are no experts in this area.
Well, it's very exciting, I think. I just did want to mention, there's a story told, I read it, and you probably have, about when the first Spanish explorers came to this country and they were off the islands. The island people
right.
really did not see those ships because they had nothing, the tall ships, the big ships, they had nothing to compare them to. They had never
right.
seen them. The only people that noticed them was their, the spiritual leader, whatever you want to call him, whether you want to call him the witch doctor or the shaman. They could see, but nobody else could. And
right.
because
right.
they'd already journeyed places in their minds, and
right.
the regular people just didn't. And I think there's a lot of that going on now. There's, don't discount something that somebody says they see because they're seeing it. And, you know, a lot of people don't, they don't go public. They don't come forward and talk about it a lot except with trusted friends.
Right.
But now more and more...
Well, some of it is very personal.
Yeah.
And some people are still afraid of being ostracized and say, that
yeah.
person is, you know, crazy, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't want to, you know, and then they're afraid their employer will find out about it and start looking at them funny and, you know. So, you know, you still have some of that, not as much as you had years ago, but you still do have some of that, but it's lessening quite a bit. And, you know, the more and more scientists, philosophers, and so on have gotten into this, and, it's much more acceptable area. And also, we have gotten from scientists now apparatus, gauges, machinery of various types in order to be able to record the effects of these anomalous phenomena. And I know that Wilhelm Reich was experimenting with what he called orgone energy or cosmic energy, and he felt the UFOs that were fueled by this energy, which is mass-free and fills the universe, and is available to anybody who knows how to concentrate it and use it as a motor force, which kind of knocks the hell out of making money out of oil. And he said that, I think we talked about this a couple of days ago when we were doing that roundup discussion, that, and he was a very exacting scientist. He came from the school of 19th century science, although he lived until 1957. In those days, a lot of scientists, they didn't have these like national state-run institutes where you had to draw protocols to get funding and all stuff. These guys just went out and they did their own experiments, you know.
Yeah.
And if they didn't have a particular instrument, they would create one or they would figure something out. And he found that he had the accumulators or enclosures that were made of both organic and inorganic material to collect this energy. And some people said, well, the guy's crazy. There's nothing. He's got an empty box. He claims there's energy in there. But what he found out is the temperature inside the box was higher than the temperature outside. So there was... there was a differential. And, I mean, if you, you took it out in 25-degree weather outside, I don't mean, you know, next to a furnace or where there's any source of heat inside the enclosure. And he found out there was still a differential. And he brought it to Einstein, who was at the time at the Institute for the Advanced Study over at Princeton, New Jersey. And Einstein looked at him and said, you know, if this is right, this is a tremendous breakthrough. Unfortunately, his assistant came up with a different explanation for it. But, you know, so what I'm saying is that people should feel more, should be free to make their own experiments. And, for instance, it's become a big thing now, but it's been going on for some time. You ever watch these paranormal investigator shows where they have equipment now, and you can buy it on the Internet to detect electromagnetic fields and, you know, temperature differentials and all kinds of different things. And they use these things to track what is called ghosts, which I simply believe is the subatomic energy bodies of spiritual entities and people who passed on who, for one reason or another, are attached to a particular area. And, you know, there's also the another thing which I hope we can get somebody on to talk to is electronic voice phenomena. And there was a book published a couple of decades ago by a Czech psychologist, a couple of Jungian investigators, and they claim that they captured anomalous voices on tape recorders. Well, today we don't more or less have tape recorders. We have other types of recording devices, although they still exist. And they claim that they were getting voices coming through from other dimensions or people who had passed on. And I've listened to recordings, legitimate recordings of some of these voices, and it's just incredibly amazing. And so I would hope to get somebody, you know, to come on and talk about that. And, you know, the point is that it's wide open. Anybody can get involved with it, you know, and, you know, you may have to do some self-education about it. You know, there are many, many books out there. You have to be a little discriminating because, and separate the wheat from the chaff.
Definitely.
There are people who, I mean, there are, well, I mean, we do know that there are I believe a small percentage of people who, you know, due to their own psychological makeup, maybe fantasizing or perhaps hallucinating or, you know, I mean, we have to acknowledge the fact that, you know, there are people who, you know, they're not on the same level playing field. That doesn't mean that they're not perceiving something, and maybe there is some reality to it, but you know what I'm saying. And you know, the vast majority of UFO sightings, according, you know, to the official authorities, are most of them are identified. I'm not so sure I believe that, but even they admit that there is at least 10% that they have no explanation for.
Yeah.
Most
of the people, the accounts I've read, I mean, there's been some that were iffy. Like you say, you have to be discerning. But most of the accounts I've read of contactees have been quite credible, actually. The people involved, many of them didn't come public till, you know, for quite a while. I mean, they weren't wanting notoriety or fame or something.
Right.
And some of them were quite troubled, but others weren't. And one of my favorite stories was a lady, and I don't remember her name, who was very religious. And when she was abducted, after she came back and she talked to people, and this was the story, she asked these beings, she said, "What about God?" Because, you know, I mean, she was thinking she was in her worst nightmare. And one of them said to her, "Well, he's the same to us as to you." And she just seemed to have such a calming effect, and she believed. And
right.
it was like, well, okay, so, you know, there is, and whether you want to call God, Supreme Being, Source, whatever, she came back, you know, with this feeling that it was all okay. And because these beings, they're doing experiments and they're trying things out just like we are.
Right.
So, you know, there's really, and I wouldn't say there's nothing to be afraid of, because there's always malevolence like there is here. You know, probably like every town.
Well, I
has
mean, there are what I call demonic entities,
right.
or what Wright called deadly psychic energies, and the occultists knew about them, and you do have to be careful.
Sure. Yeah.
So, I mean,
and also
the one big difference I have with some of the New Age theorists is, you know, it's, you know, everything is just not light and, you know, happiness and all this.
Yeah, no.
But there are destructive entities in the universe, and we do have to protect ourselves and be aware of it. And, of course, the exorcists have known this down through the centuries, going many, many, many years back. I mean, Jesus himself did exorcisms, and exorcisms have been done by Kabbalists. But, you know, so we can't assume that all of these entities from this 96% of unknown, the unknown universe are going to be friendly and helpful. So, you know, and there's many reports in which we know that that's not the case.
And here I'm not, like, trying to put blame on people, but I've noticed the people who seem more fearful or who always want to talk about the, you know, quote unquote, the dark side, the people who have dealings with entities that aren't all that friendly, those people,
right.
I mean, that's what they send out. And, you know, you're going to attract what you send out. So,
yeah, that's quite true, because they sense it and they're drawn to people that they feel that they can possess.
Sure.
And, you know, it's almost like like goes to like, you know.
Yeah, and it does. That's what I wanted to say, though, that's not always the case. You were talking about, you know, the malevolent energies and things. I worked with a woman who occasionally, well, frequently, was possessed. And she was not, I mean, you wouldn't necessarily know if you didn't know. But, like, sometimes she would come into work and she was just all fine and dandy, and other times you could tell the way she came in.
Right.
And I got tired of it, because when she wasn't in this situation, she was just smart and funny and, you know, everything. But when she was taken over, she was a real bitch, and because it wasn't her. And
right.
What, you know, I asked her a question as I would be asking her, and I got some kind of mumbles, jumble thingy, and I said, no, I want so-and-so, you know, her name, to answer.
Right.
And I got this horrible look. And, I mean, you know, like, her eyes changed, everything, when she had whatever in her. Now, in years past, they probably would have put her in an institution. But the thing was, I mean, she kept up her life perfectly well, but yet she was just, and this was not, I mean, she understood that there was something going on, but she didn't really know what to do about it at the time. And I've often wondered, because she had, like, you could see when she was battling this.
Right.
Extra energy, and it was very sad. But because she did battle, and she talked to herself when she was, I mean, well, she was talking back and forth, and finally she was fired from the place, and I just don't know. I mean, that was the only way that it interfered, like, with her life, because, you know, I don't know how long she would ordinarily keep jobs. It was just, that was the first time I ever really ran into something on a consistent basis like that.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, things, you know, these things happen, and I believe that the Vatican has laid down some very good guidelines in dealing with possible possession, which is they try to rule out natural causes before they go to the supernatural.
Right.
But once you eliminate the natural causes, then you get closer and closer to realizing you're dealing with something which is not of this earth, so to speak.
Right.
You can't automatically assume, because like I said, there are, you know, people who, for one reason or another, due to their unfortunate experiences, are suffering from various forms of mental illness, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that aside, they definitely should be gone into. And as far as the negative psychic energies, Wright called it deadly orgone energy. He discovered that this life energy, which is healing and expansive, if you accumulated it in his, what he used to call the orgone accumulator, which was commonly known by the yellow press as a box. It really wasn't a box. It was a specifically created apparatus to collect the energy. And he decided in 1952 and this was on the brink of the Korean War, during the midst of the Korean War, there was a real danger. People back then were really afraid of nuclear war to a greater extent than, you know, it's coming back a little bit now. I mean, but you remember back then, or at least I do, that, you know, was considered to be something that might really happen. And he obtained some radioactive substances, which back in those days you could obtain if you got permission from the Atomic Energy Commission and a few other. It's much tighter now, obviously. I don't think people could just, you know. Back in the 50s, he was able to get it to do an experiment. He explained he's a scientist, and, you know. So he put it in the accumulator. And, of course, the radiation is decaying matter, whereas the orgone energy is building up matter. And when the two went into a clash, it excited the orgone energy into a negative destructive force that he called deadly orgone, which penetrated everything and could not be shielded by lead, which would typically shield most of the radioactivity. And the deadly orgone energy would kill vegetation, it would deteriorate rocks, because he was up, his laboratories were up in northern Maine, and he was way out in a rural area. I visited twice over the course of my lifetime up there. It's way, way up in Rangeley, Maine. I mean, you're almost in Canada, and it's a very remote area, and, you know. Now, it's interesting to me when I watch documentaries and other shows that sometimes the paranormal investigators go into homes that they believe are infested with deadly energies, and I think there's a connection between the two, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they may say prayers and do other things but open up windows, and, you know, they have different ways of cleansing the area, which is what he was doing, you know.
Right.
And, you know, so I think in the 21st, 22nd century, if humanity survives, that there's going to be a convergence between science, philosophy, psychology, and spirituality. In other words, I think the new knowledge is multidisciplinary. And these artificial boundaries that have been set up from mechanistic science from the 18th and 19th 20th centuries, they're going to start dissolving. And this new knowledge is going to cut across a lot of different fields. Medicine, you know, astrology, not astrology, medicine, cosmology, physics, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Oh, right.
And philosophy and religion and so on.
Interdisciplinary, yeah. I mean, there is no way that we're going to be able to compartmentalize any of that. I must apologize for my neighbor's dog.
I thought that maybe she's trying to get involved in the discussion.
I don't know. Usually it's, yeah. I haven't done a show this early before, so I've gotten, so I just don't even hear it. I try to do something by next time. I mean, not to the dog. I love animals.
She said, "I want ice." She said, "I've seen quite a lot of things. Let me get in here. I'll tell you what's going on."
That's what. Yeah, but it's a loud dog. I'm on the top of the 2 flat, and it's in the yard next door in front, and I'm at my side. No, but
it sounds like it's right next to you. The way I hear it.
I know, but it's definitely not. So it's just loud.
Well, I always have cats as pets in there. As you know, they're usually very quiet.
Yeah, well, they always do now. Right now, I guess maybe because it's earlier than my cats are used to, and they're still napping. But usually when I'm like doing a show, they want to come around and, you know, like if you see on Facebook when I'm going through a whole run of misspelled things and all messed up, that's because I have help.
Right.
I mean, not that I don't misspell things on my own, but with them, I really misspell things. So
now we should mention one thing, which I hope we can have somebody on to talk about, is that there's a very famous incident, which I know you probably know about, and a lot of people listening would know about, and that is the famous 1946 Roswell incident, in which UFOs crashed out in New Mexico and the Army had recovered crafts and bodies and put it under a veil of national security. Here we go back into national security. I feel we're talking on Stewart's show now. They put it under a veil of national security, and for many years, it was kept quiet. The bodies were taken to an Air Force base, Wright Patterson Air Force Base,
Ohio,
and they were refrigerated. And the craft were taken there for purposes of study. And it's above top secret. Many presidents were not told about it, and we still don't know when, where, how. Whether they back-engineered the technology or whether they did recover anything alive. But after a number of years passed, the intimidation by the Army and the military intelligence diminished, and they went in and they interviewed a lot of people in the area. Like the Undertaker received a phone call to construct X number of coffins, the size of which were actually quite small, not adult size for humans, but more for children, which were for the bodies, and I guess to transport them. And the guy who originally investigated it was a public relations officer from a local Air Force base out there. And you have to remember, this was right after World War II, so there were quite a few installations around the country where they now probably don't exist. And he went out there, and they collected fragments of the crafts and so on. And he told his son is Dr. Jesse Marcel. He became a physician. I believe he's retired now, but he brought back little fragments, and there were writing, like hieroglyphic writings on them. And his son was asking him about them, and he said, "Son, I don't know exactly what this is, but I can tell you this is not from this world."
Right.
And they did all of this has now been documented, you know. So we do know, and I know from my friend Peter Robbins, who's spent a lifetime working this, that alien intelligences do exist, and that our national security apparatus and the Army and Air Force and all that, they have information and they have recovered artifacts. Now, the big dispute is, did they ever recover anything, any organism alive? We don't know.
Right. But, you know, you've probably read in several places, because, like, Roswell was not the first mention in the media of something elsewhere. In the, I believe it was the 1890s, there was a piece in a newspaper in the West that it said that this body was found in a farmer's field, and they said this is not from this world, and they, but it was just that, and then they went on with whatever. So it seemed like it was not a big deal. And, or if it was, I mean, they didn't make a big deal out of it. So that
well,
was
one
sort of
thing
strange.
That I remember, that's a case which, if I get you right, I think that you're referring to the case that occurred in Texas in the 1890s. And at that time, this was before the Wright brothers, but there were airships. I mean, they already had balloons that they were experimenting with, and so
like
they described it as
the blimpy things like that.
Yes, yeah. They described it as some, again, because we're going back to the fact that we will describe things based on what we already know. And there's a very, very strange and interesting story that, because they took the body and they buried the body in a local cemetery. And when investigators many, many years later went to, I think they even got a court order to disinter. I think they may have found the site or something. And apparently the body had been removed.
Okay.
So again, we have our big brother trying to prevent this information from getting out among the broad public.
There's been some. Well, you know, if Big Brother wants to control, it's not so much that they want. Well, they do want to control everything, but they'll let some of this out now, but only what they want. And now, though, it's getting out of hand. I mean, it's getting away from them, them being the big whatever. So,
well, I mean, the national security state cannot control the entire reality of the domestic population. And we're in a big country here. We're not in Luxembourg or, you know, Monaco.
Right.
I mean, we're, you know, so things happen all the time in the mountains, the plains, deserts, you know. I mean, I think that's one reason why these extraterrestrial intelligences, whether they're extra-dimensional or whether they come from actual other planets, that they seem to shy away from big cities, usually, and because they don't want to be interfered with on whatever missions they have to be doing.
That's been the truth for, well, decades and decades, but now it seems that some very large cities have had sightings. And
Recently,
very, very recently. So this is just another, I would take it as a proof that things are changing and we're going to be making, we know we've made contact. We know we've been contact.
Right.
I mean, I feel that. But it's going to be more obvious and all because they're becoming more obvious. Like you said, when something crashes in, you know, the desert, a lot of people in the past didn't know about it. Now everything's tracked,
right,
except that missing plane that they can't seem to find. But that's a whole other story. And, you know, some of the theories on that are that it was taken into another dimension. But then,
well, I mean, you know, there's the Bermuda Triangle phenomena. And who knows, this may be analogous to that. We don't know.
Right. I mean, you know, who really is to say it, unless it isn't and there's, you know, the government, whatever, doing. But other than that, yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that definitely comes to mind because the Bermuda Triangle has, for years and years, disappeared ships and planes and all of that. And there's a couple other spots on the planet. Somebody told me the ones around Japan just had a very similar experience. There's X number of square miles that disappeared things, too, like that. So, yeah, who knows?
I mean, there have been numerous aircraft as well as ships that have disappeared in what is known as the Bermuda Triangle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was some trading mission at the end of World War II. They had a whole squadron of planes out there. I don't know how many they were, but, you know, whether they were 7 or 10 or 12. You know, I'm not a military guy, so, you know, I don't know how many planes would be in a squadron, but there was more than one. How many?
I don't know either. It's like all those different terms. It's like I don't know how many people they're talking about, so I don't know what.
Yeah,
it's about.
Well, I mean, we could look it up, but the fact of the matter is, they all disappeared and they never found them. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, they were out. They went out there, and there's some theory that maybe they're whatever they used in those days to navigate, which I suppose was some form of radar. Maybe that there's an electromagnetic anomaly in the area and they got lost. You know, there's also natural explanations, but, you know, nevertheless, they disappeared and nobody ever found them.
Right. It's easier to believe, you know, one, having some kind of issue and disappearing than, like you said, however many in a squadron. But, I mean, yeah, when there's more
right.
than one. But, you know, the pilots come back and talk about things they saw. And
oh, yes. Yeah.
You're a wealth of information, actually. And it's not just the military pilots, but commercial pilots.
Right.
They've seen things. And then we know our astronauts have seen things. And I just saw recently a picture that was taken off the ISS, the International Space Ship.
Yes,
and
I saw the same thing.
Yes, and I was like, oh, wow. It was a big disc, and they were saying it was, what, between, 3,000 and 6,000 miles, they think? This was between the space station and Earth. And
I think they said it was 3,000 miles. It's a huge thing. They have no idea what it. Well, maybe they do, but they're not telling us, but it was out there.
What was impressive was that, you know, that you could tell this was not just as everything stationary, because between it and the space station were clouds. Down in that lower left hand, the clouds moved. I mean, there was something there. And,
right. Yeah,
I mean, how do you, you know, somebody got some explaining to this.
A lot of times they just don't know. And the Air Force for many years, and probably still does, has a form. They used to ask people to fill out a form on UFOs, and again, this was right after World War II. I don't know if they still have that. Jimmy Carter, incidentally, filled out such a form. He made sightings in Georgia when he was governor. Reich made sightings up in Maine. He filled out some of these forms. You know, it says, like, well, where were you? What angle from the ground was it, and all kinds of different things. So,
yeah.
But the other thing I want to say is I think there's a lot of unreported phenomena by commercial pilots who are afraid to report it because they're afraid they'll jeopardize their job.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they'll say, gee, this guy's starting to see things. Maybe he's not all that reliable. We don't want him to be flying a commercial jet with 200 people on it, you know.
Right, like
so,
maybe.
I mean,
secretly drinking, or maybe he's been doing some drugs. And
yeah, I mean, maybe he's hallucinating. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think there's as much of that as there used to be, but I'm pretty sure that, you know, that none of these guys really want to report it. I'm talking about the commercial guys, because the military people report everything. They're supposed to, and it really doesn't matter. And the military discounts a lot of stuff, so they don't even care. But commercially, I think, you know, unless it's something that really affects their aircraft where they have to explain something, I think a lot of these guys don't even talk about it. I mean, they don't report it. They may mention it to somebody sometime, but you know what I'm saying.
Right. They may talk to each other or something about it.
Yeah, but I think, you know, they don't want to be faced with, you know, we're going to ground you for a while and, you know, and look into this or whatever, you know, because that's their livelihood. I mean, they don't, you know.
Yeah. I don't blame I don't blame anybody who's a little leery right now, but I admire the people who are coming out, because the more people come out, the more others will. I mean, it's just one of those that kind of a phenomenon. So, you know, if you can, if you're not risking your job, you know, talk about it.
Right. Huh?
And I know, well, some people, their families. I don't know how does your family feel about your interest in this?
Well, I never really, you know, received much reaction, you know, in general, you know, about it. I mean, my late wife was, you know, always very tolerant about my interests. and, you know, she had her own interests, and, you know, and of course, the media, the old media, I don't mean the new media, but the, you know, this stuff has been a motion picture since the 50s, and, you know, mm-hmm. I don't think it's, you know, it's a more of an accepted topic of an investigation and of thought. And I mentioned before, there's some very good movies that point out the political aspects of this. And I think I mentioned this last time we were on. And I very highly recommend the 1951 version of The Day the Earth Stood Still. Now, The Day the Earth Stood Still, starring Michael Rennie, and there were another who was an excellent actor, and for the day, it was done very well. They didn't have a lot of the high tech effects we have now, but it was really done well, and I think I described a lot of people who've seen the movie now, particularly people who are interested in this area. The remake is a good movie, but the remake is not as good as the original, in my opinion, particularly for the storyline of the original, because the storyline of the original is that once nuclear weapons started to be used, and this was right after World War II, it alerted extraterrestrial civilizations, and we do have evidence, actual evidence, that in the real world, UFOs have been unusually attracted to nuclear installations, and according to Reich's theory, nuclear energy would influence the atmosphere and radiate out into space. So they may be picking up on it, but he came down, and it was his idea that he wanted to talk to all the leaders of the Earth and convince them that they had to stop all these conflicts and wars, because now with the weapons they were developing, they were becoming a danger to other civilizations. And I'm not going to say any more about it, but besides, it's really a thought-provoking movie, the kind that they rarely make these days. And it had science, but it also had politics, and it's a very interesting movie.
It's probably on YouTube, so much is. But because I know I've never seen it.
Well, one thing I do know, it's in DVD, and it's quite inexpensive because not only is it in DVD in several original editions, but when they remade the movie, they sold the movie, the new movie, with the old movie in one set. In other words, they gave you two discs. So, I mean, you know, you could probably pick it up for $5 at, you know, Walmart or not Walmart, you know, one of the major chains that has this kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah, I never encourage anybody to shop at Walmart if they just don't have
it. No, I know Walmart, but what I really mean is just an inexpensive place.
Right.
Or you can get it off
I'm
Amazon.
Sure.
You could probably get a used copy off Amazon for a couple of bucks.
It's $29 on YouTube. So you really, the whole movie isn't there.
Right.
It's
on the copyright. You know, it's on the copyright.
Sure. Yeah.
So anything that's on the copyright is not going to be posted on YouTube unless the owner decides to release it into the public domain. And that movie is one that has always had such a high interest that they actually remade it, so I doubt very much whether that's going to be released into the public domain. The other one
I
would point out.
Either, but I would say watch the original.
The original is the one that I think is the most thought-provoking when it comes to the political implications of all of this, which is part and parcel of the whole thing, because the ruling classes of, and when I say ruling classes, I just don't mean in this country, I mean in almost all countries, if not all countries, they have a vested interest in portraying reality in a certain way, and they like to control that, and they don't like to lose control of that, because if they lose control of that, they could lose control of the populace.
Yep.
And that is a very big fear. You know, of course, they always say they're trying to do it for the benefit of people because they'll panic, and you know. But I believe it's a control issue, you know.
And, I agree. People are underestimated, really. I mean, sometimes I think we're overestimated in certain areas and then underestimated. But, yeah, I don't hold with that thing. Oh, the people are going to panic, going to go crazy if you tell them the truth. No, some of the religions might, because some of them have made out. The ones that talk about, you know, Earth is only 5,000 years old. And, you know, I mean, I've heard of people like that, but I never knew any myself. And Monday night, Brian Stetton, with me on Progress Toward Democracy, mentioned that he had written an article his boss wanted him to write, and it was about geology and things. And he was talking about this one place, I think it's in the West, that was this had to do, I think it would have been leading up to fracking. But anyway, he mentioned that whatever this was 60,000 years old. And his boss said, oh, Brian, well, you know, I've got some problems with that because the Earth is only about 6,000 years old. And Brian, confirmed atheist that he is, or agnostic, he almost lost it. I mean, he was talking about it on the air because he also hadn't run into somebody who was really, you know, that adamant about the life of the Earth. And because they're still out there, which to me is just a whole other story.
Well, I mean, you know, that's part and parcel of free thought. The only thing there is that even religious scientists, you know that that's not the fact.
Yeah.
I mean, and that doesn't negate higher spiritual intelligences by any means. The age of the Earth is neither here nor there on that, but the scientists will tell us that's a scientific impossibility. Based on dating techniques and the things that they have. I mean, you know, whatever you want to believe and however far you want to take your investigations, you always want to check the scientists and see what they're saying about it and what their findings are, because you have to factor that in. You know, they could be wrong. I mean, I don't mean on this specific issue, but there's nothing saying that they're right on everything they do. But you do want to be aware of what the findings are, you know.
Well, and we have to remember that for different researchers, you know, different corporations fund certain schools, and they will find certain things to keep their funding. And so, I mean, it's no more honest than anything else. But when you've had all these researchers, independent scientists from way back talking about, you know, things, some things you can pretty much take to the bank. But, Stephen, last words. Words of wisdom. What would you say until next time?
Well, until next time, I would say watch the skies.
Hey, yeah, love it.
Watch the
skies. Please do. Yeah. And actually, the 10th of this month, there's something with Saturn, so you can actually see Saturn most of this month clearer than normal. So,
I'll be looking for it.
Watch the skies. Okay, my friend,
watch
thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Ruth.
Next week, okay.
Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Hey out there, everybody. Welcome to Five Rivers Radio Hour. We have a really interesting guest this week that I'm really excited to talk to. He's a person I've worked with many times before, but we've never had a chance to really sit down and kind of talk philosophy and what's going on, and he's a really fascinating character. His name is Ariel Greencraft. He's a California witch. He's a Reiki master, a musician. He's the owner of Ariel Light and Sound, a company that's provided stage management, sound, and lighting for virtually every major pagan festival in northern central California Valley and the adjacent foothills as well. He's worked as a recording artist, producer on a number of recording projects. He's a man who has made incredible magic, but from behind the scenes, which we don't usually think about, although he does occasionally appear on the stage. But he allows other people to be in the spotlight, and usually it's Ariel Light and Sound providing that spotlight. Fascinating guy. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. Ariel, welcome to Five Rivers Radio Hour.
Well, hello. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Although Ariel, you're a familiar figure in the pagan community in Northern California, but I suspect a lot of people don't know quite how much you do. Although you are a solo artist and you do have a band, so much of your work for the pagan community is behind the scenes. How would you, as somebody who's been in the spotlight and somebody who's been providing the spotlight, how would you compare the work that you do in those two arenas, either out on stage or behind the scenes stage?
Well, I guess I'm a facilitator, I suppose. I try to, you know, help other people do what they want to do. You know, I for so long wanted to perform and have been performing for many years, but a lot of times just, you know, felt it could be better, and so I just try to provide those services for the folks that that need it, I guess. I don't know. It just...
Go ahead.
Well, it started out as you know, just basically getting all the equipment for our own band so we could put on our own shows, and then, you know, the festivals basically were so, you know, somebody needed to do it for the festivals. They were renting little baby systems that you couldn't hear, you know, very well, and it just was... We tried to perform there, and it was pretty sad. So the next time I brought my own equipment, which by that time was quite a bit superior to what they had. So it was a big improvement,
yeah.
And then it just kind of grew from there. It's been going on for like 15 years now, so it's had a long time to grow. So it's a regular thing now.
Now, you have a brother who's made quite a bit of money doing the same kinds of things that you do. You've chosen to do it without necessarily that kind of financial remuneration that he's been getting. Why is that? What is it that motivates you?
He kind of does it on a whole nother level. I mean, he's in the big times, I guess you'd say. I mean, he's produced the Oscars and the Tonight Show, and I mean, you know, goes on from there, all, you know, major movies and all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, he's, you know, in the big times in L.A., and that's fine for him, you know, and someday I might, you know, be fun to go work with him, I suppose, and work on some of his fun projects, I'm sure, because, you know, he basically, you know, hangs out with all the Hollywood glitterati and all that. I mean, those are the people he works with every day. So, But that's never been my lifestyle. I just kind of like Northern California, I guess. But like I say, I've never really had to make a living at it, and so it would be nice. But like I say, I've never had to, and so I've always been able to do it as just as backup and support for my own band and for, you know, the community, basically. So I haven't had to worry about making money.
So it kind of started like with enlightened self-interest. You needed the equipment so that your bands would sound good. But then you took it that step further and started thinking, well, you know, the other bands that are going through what you were going through, and
yeah.
Then you just kind of stepped in and provided that for everybody. And
Now we just keep doing it.
we should sometime do a count of the number of shows and musicians and people that you've provided that all for. It's pretty incredible.
It would be a pretty long list. Yeah, you know, just virtually every band that has any kind of pagan connection around Northern California, anyway, all the several, you know, Bay Area bands and Tempest and Avalon Rising and Druid Sisters Tea Party, Sharon Knight and Winter. you know, Pandemonium, you know, a lot of just, you know, you name them, any of the Northern California pagan bands, you know, and they've played at our festivals one time or another.
And also on top of that, you've done, you know, background for, you know, maypole dances and spiral dances and events where you're basically playing the DJ as well.
Well, yeah, I do that.
was all of that anything you, I mean, did you ever picture yourself in that position when you started off, you know, gathering the equipment for your own band?
No, not really. It just kind of grew out of, you know, out of the need, and it was there, you know, so I just started doing it basically to fill it in. So
That's awesome.
Now I'm hoping this summer here in July, I want to go down and meet with the folks at our parent group, the Chrysalis folks down there putting on the Carter Ranch Festival.
Yeah.
And pick their brains on, you know, production and contacting bands and how to, you know, how they go about setting up that festival there, and see if we can't duplicate that up here in this general vicinity.
So now that's one of your projects that you have coming up is a new Michigan Arts Festival. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, we do have the festival we're planning this August, of course. What's the exact date? 14th, 15th, 16th, somewhere in the middle of the second weekend of August.
I think it's like 9 or 10.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, we'll be having a festival in Wilseyville at the Blue Mountain Event Center. We're having our first, Blue Mountain Music and Arts Festival, I believe is the correct name. Hopefully, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm going to pick the brains of these fellows down south there is to get ideas to improve that festival. And hopefully we're off to a good start already. I've got a few acts already recruited, and hopefully we have some more. And I think we're going to have a nice little startup festival here. But, you know, I think we can do a lot more, and that's why I want to go down and talk to the folks down there and see what we can do, because their festival is basically, it's getting on the map, so to speak.
Yes. So I'm assuming the word retirement is not even part of your vocabulary, right?
No.
You don't get to retire, you just die doing what you're doing.
Right. I'll just go on. I just won't have to go to my day job anymore, which is, it's a good job right now, but it, you know, I don't have to do that anymore in another year or so. But that just frees me up to do more mischief like this.
So what are your talk a little bit about your personal vision and hopes for the Blue Mountain Music and Arts Festival. What would you like to see that become? What are you going to work toward it becoming?
Oh, I don't know, Woodstock West. I don't know.
No big
whatever
ambition.
Happens. I'm open, you know, to see what happens.
Talked about,
you know?
the great call to the tribes. I was like, okay,
yeah,
let's all gather and find out where the majority.
Yeah, you got to start small and get the ball rolling, you know.
Right, and that's something you also seem to understand.
In other words, I'm not crazy to think we're going to do that in Blue Mountain, but I just think, you know, you got to start somewhere, and I don't think there's any reason to think any other than big, you know what I mean? Just keep going.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Let it grow.
Now, that's kind of a – I was actually planning on later on in the interview asking this, but this kind of fits in really well. You know, as somebody who has done a million different events, some of them very small, some of them very large, what would you say to young pagans who want to get involved in these kinds of events and building these sort of institutions for the pagan community about starting small and yet still having a big vision? What advice would you give to the young people that want to start getting involved in these things?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I guess to me it's just all about volunteerism, you know, and doing what you believe in, you know. I believe in music and the arts and that sort of thing, and that's, you know, I think our highest calling, and I think, you know, I'm just doing whatever I can to facilitate that in any direction I can. Basically, that's where I'm at.
You've also seen things that you've worked with start off really small that somebody might think, oh, well, that's not doing anything, and then watched it, you know, mushroom and grow. Can you talk about any events that you've done in the past that you've watched grow that way?
Well, I suppose I don't know what all I'm done. I've been working with the Pagan Pride Festival since that first started in the late 90s, 99 or so. And then basically Gail Detmers, I think, was involved in putting on the first one there. And I just kind of showed up and volunteered for that one. But then after that, I was hooked and been working on, you know, as a committee member ever since, basically, and one way or another.
What size was the Sacramento Pagan Pride when you first started at it?
It was pretty good. We had a pretty good turnout even the first year. I think it was a few hundred people, I suppose.
And then you watched it grow to thousands.
From that one festival, now there's several festivals that go on, and the community has grown to where there's large public gatherings on every major Sabbath, and so I've seen a lot of stuff happen in those 15 years or so since we started.
Your advice would be if somebody feels the call and it's in their heart to do something, to go ahead and do it and not worry about it if it, you know, it has the potential to start small and become amazing, and not only become amazing itself, but like you said, kind of branch off to other festivals that come out of it. So the basic motivation is just do what your heart tells you to do when you want to get involved.
Yeah, for me, yeah, it's follow your bliss or whatever you want to call it, that sort of thing. I'm just driven to play music and to perform music, and on the way along there, I'm able to, because I have a good rapport with technology, I suppose. I'm able to help other people to accomplish their ends in music and recording in different ways, like, you know, in video production and those kinds of things.
You just made a very comic thought go through my mind. For a little bit of background, Ariel and I went down to work on an interview with an amazing guy down in San Francisco yesterday, and we stopped at Ocean Beach for a while, and I stupidly put my shoes in the car and started walking on the hot sand and ended up with a blister on my foot. So when you said follow your bliss, my mind automatically said follow your blister. And I'm like, and that's actually not a bad thing to say about pagan leadership too. You follow your bliss and the blisters that you will get doing the work. So, yeah, follow your bliss and your blister.
It was a beautiful day at the afternoon. I guess it was worth a blister.
Yeah, it was definitely worth it. I mean, it was San Francisco. Hello, you give me 10 blisters, I'll still go.
Ocean Beach is a pretty magical place, too.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about your spiritual journey. You're a witch. Yeah. You're a Reiki master.
Yeah.
Consider yourself Wiccan, or just more kind of general witch?
Yeah, just a general witch. I don't know what you call it. Well, let's see. It's hard to describe. I first basically awakened as a witch back in the 60s, believe it or not, living in a hippie commune, one of those kind of situations, and ran across a couple other folks who had some books by Gardner and a couple other folks, and we started doing full moon circles and, getting into it, So I've been at it for a while.
Now, there's a lot of people out there that don't have the experience of sort of the communal living, and I think that's kind of a fascinating way to come to paganism from the first time. Can you talk about how you ended up on a commune? What was your spiritual leanings then?
It's nothing all that mystical or anything. It's just basically it was a group of, starving, semi-employed students trying to survive. So we all kind of threw our money in the pot and were able to rent a house.
Nice.
It was a survival technique of that era, basically.
Was there a lot of exploring going on as far as spirituality and finding different ways of seeing the world?
Since a lot of, most of the gang there was either going to school or something, so there was a fairly intellectual atmosphere in general, so we'd sit around and talk about things like what was going on in the world in those days, which was quite a bit. And in fact, we used to try to do what we called activism, where we'd go out and do kind of act out in public and try to, raise people's awareness on different issues and stuff. And basically go in the street with a tape recorder and do like crazy interviews and stuff, because we didn't have video or anything in those days. And just ask people, you know, questions about the issues of the day and try to get, you know, information from people and see what was going on, stuff like that. And then, well, we had, you know, more nefarious activities, too. We did some interesting things. We did sweat lodges with an Indian tribe up at Tahoe, things like that. Vision quests, the whole thing. I mean, we went through a whole shamanic thing together, the group of us, pretty much. And so that was kind of fantastic. But
What school were you guys going to?
Excuse me? Different ones, actually. Sac State, American River, City College, whatever. You know, people were going to the different schools around town. They're mostly students of one kind or another, you know, trying to maintain our student deferments, basically, at that time, so we didn't get drafted, you know.
Yeah,
that's the way it was in that case. Anyway, I ended up, that's what took me away from all this wonderful life, was that I ended up getting, well, I was going to be drafted, so I enlisted to avoid the draft, basically. So, yeah, it was that or go to Canada, and I had, I already had friends in Canada, so I had a place to go. So,
I had a brother enlisted because he knew he had a choice of what he could do, and he wanted to be a medic and not carry a gun, so I figured if he enlisted, he'd have a better chance, since they were going to draft him anyway.
My exact logic. That's why I enlisted, so I could be a medic. And that's why I ended up as a medic. And even then, though, they were trying to convince me to switch over to work on computer systems and stuff. This was way back in the, when was this, in the 1969, 70, right in there. So
yeah, you've been also been a part of the computer revolution since its inception, practically.
Well, yeah, I was actually already writing programs in 68, 69. I was going to City College at the time, taking a chemistry class, and got my hands on a computer and a book on Fortran.
For those who don't know Sacramento's City College is the sort of downtown college. It's where all the bohemians and artists and writers and musicians. So it's always been a school of a lot of foment, which is awesome, actually. How did that work for you? Did you ever go over to Vietnam as a medic? Did you?
No, actually, I was in the service. I did my 4 years and got out, but I never did get overseas. I worked pretty much. It was like a day job. I just worked in a hospital, and that was it, you know. So all in all, it wasn't a bad gig. And ended up getting a lot of good training out of the deal. I was able to qualify for my nursing boards when I got out, and I'd also been trained as a surgical technician. So, I was able to do quite well for myself when I got out. So
that's excellent. I think it's interesting that even in that, you were drawn to a healing profession, and as you do now with your witchcraft and also with the Reiki stuff.
Right.
You're also a Reiki master, which means not only a practitioner, but you can teach Reiki.
That's a whole other journey. I started out. It's a long story. If you want to tell it, I can try to do the nickel version. What's that?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Oh, you're cutting out a little bit on the phone.
Sorry about that.
It's all right. I started out as a youngster, really quite young. At 10 or 11, I got to hold my hands on a book on yoga, and for some reason started doing yoga. Up to that point, I had been a good little Catholic boy, an altar boy, and the whole thing, you know.
Yeah.
So for some reason, I was attracted to yoga, and then started doing yoga meditations and doing the postures, and, you know, on a regular basis. I even cleared out a closet in my parents' house so that I would have my own private space for meditation. And they were cool with it. They're pretty open-minded folks. I had some great parents. I can't complain at all. Then, you know, eventually at that point in the church, as a Catholic, you were supposed to go through confirmation. And at that point, you know, it got me seriously thinking about what was going on there, and it didn't add up for me. So basically, I discussed it with my parents, and that was it. They let me quit being an altar boy and going to church and all that fun stuff. And I became,
yeah,
I don't
know
what that
was. Yeah, I talked to my parents. They tried to, you know, grab me and keep me in the church as long as they could.
Yeah. Well, you know, my grandmother was a little more upset about it. but she's a whole other story. So,
so you started off with yoga as opposed to during your confirmation. I love that.
Yeah.
And what happened?
Yeah.
Keep going. What happened?
Well, actually, it's even weirder than that, because actually a couple of years before that, I had spontaneously started to travel outside my body. So,
so you were already gifted before you really knew what it was.
Yeah, and I, you know, at that time, I just thought it was a fun trick. You know, I didn't realize exactly what it was. you know, I could fly around at night before I went to sleep. You know, it was kind of neat, and go anywhere I wanted to go. And I thought it was just sort of like, you know, lucid dreaming, but it was actually, found out later, I was actually astral traveling. And so now I'm fairly adept at that now, so I can do any part of me that I need to, can go anywhere I need to at a whim. It's pretty cool.
You know, it's funny, for me about that age, it manifests for me in times when I just wanted to get away, because I did not have the cool parents that you had. And there were times that I just needed to get away, and I learned to make myself invisible. And friends of mine still complain that I sometimes spontaneously do that. It's like, stop that.
Yes, I know you do that. I've seen you do that.
It's like, it's just habit. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. So one of these days,
I mean,
you guys,
yeah,
have
we'll
to
turn
like
around
lock
and
up my...
Michael was here just a minute ago. I swear he was.
You have to lock up my invisibility cloak so I can't do it. But it's amazing as kids how we find our spiritual gifts.
Yeah.
Finding our spiritual gifts before we ever really even know what they are, that they are spiritual gifts, is, I think, one of the reasons that every great teacher has always said, listen to the children, pay attention to the children. They get it. You know?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, like I say, this started happening to me at a fairly early age, and, you know, who do you talk to about that? You know, certainly.
You had your first Holy Communion, you astro-traveled.
Yeah.
You gave up your confirmation for yoga. Keep going.
Yeah.
This is a great story.
Well, and then besides that, my grandmother taught me how to read futures using playing cards.
Wow.
At the same time, she was giving us catechism classes. So.
Yeah, I know. They're amazing, some of these old Catholic women who do magic, and they just don't call it that.
Yeah, yeah. And then my grandfather taught us how to do divining and a few other things like that, reading tea leaves and things of that nature at an early age. So there's a tradition in the family, I guess you'd say, that is not really acknowledged, but it's definitely there.
There's a great scene in a movie called The Secret of Inishmore. The Secret of Roninish. Got the wrong island. Where the mother tells them to stop talking the old superstitions, and then proceeds to do a blessing with the goddess Bridget at the hearth before she fixes dinner.
That's typical of the old
world Catholic women. You know, they still did the magic. They just called it after a saint instead of a goddess.
Yeah, I remember her cooking, throwing salt over her shoulder. Why you do that? Oh, you got to do it. Keep the luck away. This is what you do. It was there all the time, you know. And now that my grandmother has passed, we're great buddies now.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Working across the veil as well as out of the body.
Yeah.
So how did that progress into the Reiki? What sort of called you to the Reiki?
The yoga, I kept doing yoga, and I was, of course, involved in other athletics and stuff like that. I played football and track and all that kind of stuff. But I always, you know, used the yoga to kind of keep my body straight, you know, and keep my energy right, you know, that sort of thing. And then it was just kind of, it's like, to me, a habit now. You wouldn't hardly even notice I was doing it, except I look like I'm doing funny things. it gets to be part of your life, you know. And then I got older, you know, hanging around with a bunch of guys, I got into martial arts and all that and studied, started out in Taekwondo like everybody does. And, you know, that was very nice, and it progressed through that fairly easily and studied it for, you know, a couple of years while I was in the military and, didn't formally get a black belt, but probably got close to that level of training anyway. I knew all the katas there were on the planet, I tell you. I could break every brick and stick you handed to me. But that was, like I say, while I was in the military. And then when I got out, I got back here to Sacramento and got more involved in Aikido and into a Japanese Renbukai, which is swords and all that, with the kids and stuff that we took my kids, basically, you know, so they would study martial arts. And this was the school that was in the neighborhood, so that's what we studied. And that was very interesting, but it was a little more militaristic than I liked because, you know, a lot of sticks and swords and all that stuff. But it was good skills, and it was good discipline for the kids. Plus, they were also learning the basic martial arts as well. Right. So that was good. And then I worked with, and then I eventually ended up in a group called the Guardian Angels, and I studied, got involved in an Okinawan Shaolin group there, and studied with them for several years.
Could you explain who the Guardian Angels are for people who aren't familiar?
That was a group originated in New York City with a fellow named Curtis Sliwa, who's an amazing character. And the subways were so dangerous, you know, that people couldn't safely ride there. So these guys basically went as a group to, you know, to make things safe, would travel on the subways and just, you know, at random and kind of make sure people were safe. And even the police finally endorsed them and realized these guys know what they're doing and they, you know, it's a good thing. So it's gradually spread throughout the country. And this by what about, 1979, 1980, around in there, we opened a branch here in Sacramento, actually a group of friends of mine, another like a commune, but kind of a floating one, tried to form our own kind of guardian angel-like group. And then just about the same time, Curtis Sliwa came to town, so he stole our thunder. So those of us that were physically up to the challenge went ahead and joined the group, and because it was a pretty high level of, capability that they expected. They didn't want any wimps, basically. And just, you know, you put you through about a two-hour workout to see who could take it, you know, and who was willing to work out hard enough. And you had to keep showing up and showing up and showing up before you would make it into the group. So it was pretty selective. We ended up with a group of about two dozen, I think, at the end, from hundreds of people that started out. And
I remember the Guardian Angels start in Sacramento. We didn't know each other back then, but I remember.
Every one of these guys had at least a black belt in some art. One guy was a professional boxer. I mean, they were a pretty gruesome bunch, I tell you. I mean, you wouldn't want to mess with any of them.
To be messed with.
Yeah, and we had, you know, severe workouts, and then we were constantly training new recruits and, you know, So you could bounce a quarter off any muscle on my body at that point. I was in pretty good shape. it was a lot of fun and good community service, and it was great. We're getting kids, you know, that, you know, wanted to do something positive for the community, and it was just a really neat thing, you know.
You know, I really find it fascinating with the variety of experiences you've had growing up. They all seem to always focus back on healing, either personal healing or healing people or healing the community. And that's definitely a theme in your life. I find that pretty fascinating.
That's where I always seem to end up,
But you didn't have like the 10-year plan in front of you. Like, say, go healing step number 5, I do this. But it was just natural for you to go for that. Speaking of natural, your magical name is Greencraft.
Mm-hmm.
So your obviously very much focused on the natural world and the healing that derives from that, the energy that derives from that, and the wisdom. Can you talk a little bit about that, your relationship with the natural world, and how that's fit into this whole journey of yours?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I do have an eighth or a 16th, we're not sure exactly, of Native American blood. So I got a little bit there. We're trying to verify the exact, you know, it's hard to document some of those cases. But I have a couple of ancestors from Oklahoma, so we're trying to find out exactly who they were. But anyway, I feel it. And like I say, when we were in this commune group in the 60s there, we did an entire, you know, shamanic thing. I mean, we went through, the whole vision quest and the whole, you know, we spent a lot of time in smoky buildings and running in the forest and stuff. And, not to make light of it by any means, it was a whole spiritual journey. And so in that way, you know, I mean, I have, spirit animals and all that I work with on a regular basis. And shamanic journeying is part of my normal practice. So,
interesting. A lot of folks who went through the sort of revolution of thought and the spiritual revolution during the 60s gained a lot of wisdom from the East and a lot of wisdom from the Native Americans. At what point in your personal journey did you start discovering that there was also a tradition in Europe as far as the natural world and similar spirituality with the shamanic and the connection to getting their wisdom from nature?
Yeah. Well, like I say, in that same commune experience, I became connected with some folks who were familiar with the current English witchcraft flame. And Gardner, we had a couple of books from Gardner, and that's basically what we were trying to practice at that point. And so that kind of, like I say, to me, it very much felt like, you know, East and West and all coming together. You know, I could see it, even feel it even then, you know, that was, there was a completeness about it. And even then, I, you know, with my yoga background, and I was, you know, had already been doing quite a bit of martial arts and that by then. And to me, I felt this East and West coming together, you know, kind of a feeling even then. And I still feel that's going on now. It's a completion of all the philosophies, you know, developing to their fullest extent. And in doing that, they hearken back to even the earliest times, and it all kind of makes sense at that point, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And with the interview that we just did with Davi Kopanawa, who is sometimes called the Dalai Lama of the rainforest, it came to the fore yet again that when we connect to the natural world, as all of our ancestors did from whatever part of the world we're in, that suddenly the differences have a context. You know, we can celebrate our differences because we all have this amazing, you know, connection spiritually, scientifically, socially, that derives from the land. So I agree with you. I think that's very definitely happening more and more.
Yeah, well, if you're in tune with your environment, personally, when I'm meditating, I can actually feel some sort of emotion. I suppose it may be the rotation of the earth, but it definitely feels like a pull from the west. I can, you know, there's like a lean to the west if I sit the right way. and with that, I can always tell, you know, which way I'm going and stuff. But I think, you know, if you're sensitive to the planet and that rotation, you know, you can feel that time is a spiral. You know what I mean?
yes. And it was interesting, even
cyclical.
Though
like he was talking about the everything is in a circle. There's a great circle of everything, that everything is within, and all those circles are within the circles, or something he was talking about. It's pretty cool.
That was one of my favorite parts of that interview was when, you know, we started talking about it, and I drew the line and went, you know, beginning, middle, end, and talking about that's what he knows as sort of the white people mindset, you know. And then I was telling him our ancestors also, and I started drawing the spiral, and it was amazing. His eyes lit up, We looked at each other. We knew exactly where we were. There was this commonality. Just in that little drawing of the spiral, we both, you know, there was a connection that was made. And
I was there. I could hear the click.
Yeah. That was exciting. And that's, you know, even language barriers can't separate us when we find that connection to the cycles of the earth and of life.
He understood that as a white man, you were subject to the straight line deal, but as someone who's practicing your tribal religion, he understood that we still may have some spark of it there, I think.
Right.
So maybe hopefully we gave him hope for us. I think, you know.
I think so too, because the Yanomami tribe, for those of you who don't know, Davi has been traveling and he just wrote a book advocating preserving the rainforest. He's going to be actually the interview next week. So
we're talking about it like it happened, but yeah, it's going to be on next week. So
yeah, and I forgot the point that I was going to make about him. But and his experience with white people is basically a bunch of greedy gold miners that came in, cut down their trees, burned parts of their forest, brought in measles and syphilis and all these diseases that didn't exist among his people. So the fact that he's even willing to come up here and talk to us, I find very admirable, because I'm not sure I would have been quite as forgiving. But that's a story for next week. People need to tune in and hear that. And when you are listening to that interview with Davi, it's Aerial Light and Sound back behind the scenes, making it all happen, as you always do with stuff in Northern California. Could you, talk to a little bit about, you know, your work as a witch, as a Reiki master, is sometimes very private, sometimes extremely personal, and yet you also have this amazing public work that you do with the festivals and stuff. How do you balance those two in your own mind and your own spirit?
Let's see. Well, actually, you know, it's in most of my life, I'm what they call out of the broom closet nowadays. So you know, I don't try to hide the fact that, you know, I practice these things, so everybody knows about it. So even the, you know, people on my day job and all that. So, I just, you know, try to. Let's see, I'm trying to get the point on the question. Let's see.
Well, it's there's sometimes this tension between, do you want to stay solitary and do your personal practice, and or do you want to be, you know, public? And yet, for you, it doesn't seem to be an either or. It seems to be something that you weave together quite well. And so I was asking how you do that, the public you versus the private you. How do you weave those?
I don't really have a very private me, I guess. when I decided to come out of the broom closet, I guess, I decided to just, you know, be as open as I can about what it is I do and who I am and all that. And because I think people need to know about that in order to deal with it, you know. It's just like, you know, you're very public about coming out of the closet as a gay man. To me, coming out as a you know, publicly as a practicing witch and psychic or whatever you want to call it, healer or curandero or brujo, whatever you want to call it, you know, and some people are scared by that, and I want people to not be scared by that. I want, you know, people to feel that that's a positive thing. I want to, you know, emphasize the healing aspects of the arts that we practice.
So in a sense, the way to get people over their fear is just to be there. Let them put a face to the name.
To say, here I am. You know, I'm a witch.
That was one of the things, speaking of the gay coming out of the closet, Harvey Milk always said, come out of the closet, let the people around you know that they have one of those people near them, and suddenly their perspective completely changes. Because, like, well, he's a cool guy, and he's rich, you know.
Yeah.
That's So basically, the weaving for you was just being consistent with who you are and honest with who you are, wherever you were.
Well, now, and I'm at a point in my life where it can't do me, and nobody can. I feel, you know, like it can't do me harm. Nobody can harm me because of my public, you know, being open about my faith and my faith, I call it faith, my practice of, you know, whatever I do.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think sometimes people think that the more you hide, the safer you are, but really it's the closet that makes you vulnerable, because then you have to defer everything, you have to deflect everything, you know.
Well,
whereas
and I feel lucky to live in California, and even, you know, but even here I've heard of cases where people have had serious issues with child custody and that sort of thing, just because they're Wiccan practitioners and whatever. There are still some ignorant judges out there who, you know, just go wacko on that and will try to take people's kids away from them and all this. It's just crazy. More so in other parts of the country, I know, but I've had, there are even currently cases like that, and that's just wrong.
I've talked to friends in the South who said, if I came out of my town, I would not survive, which is really tragic that we still have that.
There are, unfortunately, quite a few places still like that, and at my day job, so to speak, I work in a hospital, and there's a very international crowd of employees there, and many of them come to me for, you know, witch services, you might say, whatever you want to call it, for, you know, card readings, for Reiki, for just, you know, general readings, healings, whatever they need, candle magic, whatever it is to fill their need, you know. So
that reminds me of that story that when we interviewed Janet for this radio show, Janet Ferrer, and she was talking about the farmer whose cows were drowning themselves in these tiny little streams, and the farmer went to the priest, and he basically said, "I can't help you with that. You need to go see the witch."
And it's like I say, I, not so much from people from this country, but a lot of foreign people, especially, you know, from the Far East, and even Europeans that come to me when they need the services of a witch, and I'm glad to provide for them. So that's one thing about being open. And in these days, like I say, it's a positive thing.
Have you, since you've pretty much been out, you know, longer than some of our listeners have been alive, and we tend to think of how incredibly brave it is to be able to do that. Have you ever faced any kind of danger or recriminations for being as out as you are?
No. I guess I don't know if it's, I don't know why, but I don't know if it's what it is about me, but I've had a few people say weird things now and then, but nobody has actually got up in my face and said, you know, you're an evil witch, you're going to go to hell and stuff like that, you know, because I could, you know, talk to them and tell them why I think they're entirely wrong. But, you know, so I don't know. I don't know if it's, you know, my size, or I'm not that big, but I suppose my energy could be imposing to some people. But nobody seems to want to challenge me.
That's true. Well, you know, that was actually one of the things that I wanted to ask you as well, is you have been involved in the pagan community in Northern California for so long, and you seem to always be able to walk above, you know, the witch wars and the conflicts and the egos and the things that pop up. Do you have any advice for other pagans as to how to avoid some of the petty dramas and just keep doing your work that you believe you need to do?
Oh, well, you know, all these folks in the community are my dear friends, and even if I may have differences of opinion with them sometimes, we all love each other, and we're all working for the same goal here. I guess I'd say if you approach the whole thing with love in your heart, love is unconditional, and, you know, if somebody pisses you off now and then, that's just getting along with life, and if you look at it from their point of view, you'll usually see that, you know, they have a point, too, so I try to...
It's more a family squabble than anything else.
Yeah, you know, and generally time heals those kind of things, and if people are adult enough to admit they were wrong or not, or just let it slide sometimes, and usually it's for the better of everybody if those things are just left in the past, so...
Yeah, I think sometimes we forget that if the system can have us fighting each other, they're perfectly happy to do that, because then they don't have to do anything. They just sit back and watch us thrash each other.
Yeah. It doesn't get anywhere. I want to make one statement about, being a public witch. You know, I say, we're here and we're magic and you can't burn us anymore. So there.
I love it. You don't have the tool to get rid of us anymore. Well, and I think that, again, what you talk about being out of the broom closet and being where people can see you and know who you are, they recognize your value in their life, even if their, their own spiritual tradition is kind of iffy on witches. They still realize this is a nice guy, and, he can do stuff, and I can go ask him for some help with things. And that's kind of the role that witches have always played in the culture.
Yeah. I try to fulfill that role,
Cool.
But those that can accept it,
When you talk about your spirituality, one of the things I love about it is it's a lot about what you do. It's not just a philosophical level, but it's a complete lifestyle for you. If you were to try to describe your belief system to somebody, how would you do that? What would you say about what is being a witch?
Well, like I say, I've kind of, in my own particular practice, blended East and West, coming from, originally just sort of a homemade half-assed gardenerian that we read out of a book, from a long time ago, and tried to keep, that spirit alive, even though I was, not involved with the coven until many, many years later. And when we actually got in, and I worked with an actual active coven for several years in a row, and that was just a very powerful experience. But by that time, I had also gone far in my journey in Eastern studies, and that whole thing came together, really, as I matured and got older. And so to me, it's a blending of the family traditional and Celtic background of witchcraft that I've learned, and then the Eastern practices that I've learned from, several masters that I've had over there. Most notable is a Master Ni, who's a noted Taoist and Shaolin teacher. And I've studied quite seriously in all these areas. I think to me, I can't claim any one of them as my tradition, because to me there's a combining of all these that make up what some other people have called the Church of Me.
Yeah.
That's all I can claim.
I think that's one of the beautiful things about our tribal ancestors from whatever part of the world. Usually they recognize the value of differences and diversity, because the more varied talents you have, the better off everybody is. And so that perspective, and seeming like it takes you away from one tradition or another, is actually one of the things that ties you to those traditions, that you find your own power, your own path, your own direction. So we started talking about your journey into Reiki. At what point did your study of Reiki become kind of a very conscious process? Did you meet a Reiki master that you wanted to study under, or was it just something that you heard about for a long time and wanted to learn, or...
Yeah, that was kind of it. I'd heard about it. I had been doing what's called Qi Kung, which is a Shaolin healing practice using Qi energy, okay? But it's very vigorous and it's very intense, okay? It works. It does heal, But it's a lot of work for the practitioner. It's very tiring.
Okay,
hey, I'm getting older. I can't keep this up forever. So anyway, that I had heard about Reiki and finally... had a chance to take a class, and it just opened a whole new door for me and said, oh, man, this is way cool. I got to do this. So it, to me, was bringing the best from, the stuff I had learned in martial arts in working with chi and the body and energy flows through the body and all that sort of thing. Even if, they call it martial arts, there's a lot of other things going on there besides beating people up and,
right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
after you get past all the fighting and all that, there's a whole lot more going on. So, like I said, we were studying herbs, we studied healing arts, reading energies, all different kinds of things, what they call feng shui, all that sort of stuff was part of the Shaolin practice that we studied. So going from that to Reiki was just like a refinement to me into a focal point, you might say, for healing. And it just like it made the whole process much easier and smoother.
I really like how all the way along your path, it's the natural world provides that touchstone. You know, people who hear about things like Reiki, oh, you move energy around like it's some sort of mystical, unimaginable thing. But it's like every time we breathe, every time we pick up something, every time we make a recipe, we're manipulating energy in the world. You know, it's just doing it in a slightly different way that most people don't know about. And so really, it's just still a part of the natural world that you're dealing with. Is that a fair
right.
characterization?
Well, yeah. And to some people, it's all a mystery. But to make it real is imagine when you see these martial arts guys on TV breaking the bricks and breaking the sticks and all that sort of thing. Well, what energy they're using is really not the energy of their fist so much as the energy of chi that they're focusing in their fist, okay, or their head or whatever body part. Once you learn to focus that chi, you can learn to use it for other things like healing. So most of the folks you see doing that on TV and that are at a fairly rudimentary stage of their evolution, you might say, but they may have more skills than that, I would hope. But they, you know, but that's not the advanced form of chi.
With chi is just kind of a more advanced form of, I don't know, stepping out into the sunshine when you want to warm up. You're taking advantage of energy that's outside you that connects with you. It's really
well,
not so.
The beauty of Reiki is that it's like having a magnifying glass to focus that energy. That you're turning into specific frequencies of the energy that allow you to focus the healing, you know, exactly where and how you need it, and also give you it opens you up to a feedback mechanism that helps you to understand and monitor the flowing of energy through a person's body.
Right.
So in that way, it's a much more sophisticated use of chi than breaking bricks and sticks. But it's still the same energy, and that's what, you know, I try to get people to understand.
I once had a guy ask me if I could move energy around. I'm like, well, yeah. And he described this whole thing of putting a pencil on one side of the table and wanting to move it to the other side of the table, and he couldn't do it. And he asked me if I could, and I said, yeah. And he said, well, would you show me? I said, yeah. So I got into this meditative state, picked up the pencil, and moved it to the other side of the table. And he goes, that's not magic. I said, I'm moving energy. I mean, you know, save the psychokinesis for an inner Turkish prison and really need it, you know. You already have the capacity to move the pencil.
Well, there is a trick that I am able to do at certain times, and it's pretty fun if you can pull it off. And I call it chi balls. It's an old martial arts trick where instead of actually breaking a brick or anything, you just build up all that energy and just throw it across the room. And you can actually make like a little, you know, blast of wind go across the room and knock something over. It's kind of cool.
Oh, that's very cool.
And, you know, I've been able to pull that off quite a few times, but it's, you know, it's not that difficult, you know. But it's
so what do Reiki masters do for fun? Chi balls.
Yeah.
I think you may have just started a whole new trend here, Ariel.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is the game in the Harry Potter books? Our brains aren't. But now we can replace it with chi ball.
Quidditch. Yeah.
Quidditch. Yeah. Yeah. We'll have chi ball sports teams.
Chi balls fly pretty fast, and they're ephemeral as can be.
Yeah,
they're just a ball of energy. So, but they are very real, and I can even move a pencil across the table. I've definitely knocked some bugs sideways and stuff.
Yeah, I've sort of done that and then felt really bad
things
afterwards.
Well, no, I mean you don't actually hit them; you just throw the chi ball at them. Makes them fly back.
I've done that, but it was, you know, out of stupid motivation, like I was upset.
Well, yeah, if a bee
is
getting ready to sting you or something, you know.
Yeah.
It's usually a reflex.
So, another question I want to ask you, since you've been an out part of the pagan community since the 60s, how have you seen the pagan community change over the years?
Oh, it's, you know, been kind of fits and starts. There's a lot more people coming out, you know, into the community. I see, you know, folks that first get involved and they're all enthusiastic and want to change the whole world, and then they kind of get involved and run into some of the apathy and people doing nothing and get cooled off. But some of them keep going, and some new folks are always coming along. It's just like any community, and, you know, I think it's hopefully people now are, with all our work over the last 20 years or so here, people are feeling more open and able to come out into the public. That's why we keep doing the work we're doing, I guess, to try to let people know it's okay to be, you know, to be pagan and to be open about it, and that they can't stop us. Like I said,
now,
we're
you,
here
would
and
you,
we're not going anywhere.
Would you say that the many festivals you've worked at over the years have been a part of that coming out process, making it safe?
Very much so. A lot of folks have that I know now in the community have told me, well, first contact I had with the community was at such and such festival, and I met all these wonderful people, and now this, my whole life has changed. You know, I've heard a lot of people say that in the last 5 and 10 years. So hopefully we're doing some good.
For those folks who are crazy enough to be out when the other people aren't, building those kinds of venues, institutions in our community is a good thing for those that come after us. So we've got about 5 minutes left. Would you like to talk about what are some of the projects that you're working on now, things that you have going now that you're feeling good about?
Well, like I mentioned, we've got a couple of recording projects we're just wrapping up here. We just came out with a movie to go along with your book, all kinds of stuff. But we got the big festivals coming up. I'm taking off right after we finish this interview. I'm heading for a big Beltane festival up in Blue Mountain. So I'll be up there all weekend. We'll be playing up there, and there's going to be, I guess, several of the local dance troupes and some musicians, and we're going to have a big show up there. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Anybody's not doing anything, come on up to Wilsieville.
And it's a camping thing, too, so you basically
you get to live
the pagan village for a weekend. That's awesome.
Yeah, there's camping, very inexpensive camping, like $20 a person for the whole weekend or something like that, and then there's even food service available there and all kind of fun things. So it's a neat place. So we're going to have that festival this weekend, and then we got in August at the same location, the big festival coming up there, the Blue Mountain Music and Arts Festival, the very first and of many, I hope. Like I say, in July, I'm planning to go check out the Carter Ranch Festival and pick their brains for all I can to see what we can do to make this better. And also our ongoing activities here with house concerts. And we've got, I don't know if we've got any currently scheduled, but we will have something going on, I'm sure. And then we've got the radio show going on, and we got lots of things happening. So,
yeah, and I don't think we mentioned that one of your many hats is also a board member for Five Rivers Bardic Arts Collective, and your connection to Chrysalis. Any last words, advice for pagans, or for maybe for some of the elders? How do you keep going when you get tired?
Oh, drink lots of coffee.
And hydrate. Thank you,
hydrate,
Ariel.
Hydrate,
it's been really awesome
one
talking to you.
Front of the other.
And
onward into the future.
Thank you much. And this is your host, Michael Gorman, Five Rivers Radio Hour, signing off. Thank you all for listening. Next week, the interview with Davi Kopanawa, the Dalai Lama of the rainforest. Don't miss it.
Happy Beltane.
Happy Beltane. Thank you, Dan.
Yeah.
And I'll get the recording to you real soon for the Davi interview.